Call the House Special Committee on Fisheries to order at approximately 3:10. Today is March 29th, 2010. And we'd ask everyone here in the audience in Juneau to turn off their cell phones or at least put them on silent if they would, please. At the committee table, we have President Representative Munoz, Book, Millett, myself, Chair Edgman. And we should be picking up a couple additional members as time goes on here. We have two items on the agenda today. HCR 15, which is the Bristol Bay Mining Study. And time-dependent, we should be able to get to House Bill 266, Personal Use Fishing Priority, which would be the third hearing on that bill. And we have a number of folks in the audience on behalf of both bills. So with that, not seeing any comments from committee members, Representative Osterman, do you want to come to the table, please, and provide us any comments that you wish to on HCR 15? The committee did hear this measure last session. We attempted to hear it a couple of weeks ago, but weather permitted, Representative Osterman, or the bill sponsor was not able to be here, so I have the record reflect that Representative Kawasaki has joined the committee hearing. So with that, good afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate you taking up the resolution today. I'm Alan Osterman. I'm a representative from Kodiak Island, District 36. My district during the last census was expanded from Kodiak Island to the Lake Clark, Iliamna area. And I have eight villages that are represented in that area. And as you can see, Mr. Chairman, from this map, I put a big X right over here, and then yellow highlighted areas are all the communities in that area that I represent for my district. And those communities that you see there are just my district. If you look downstream from there, you get into King Salmon, Naknek, and a number of other areas that are in that area of concern. The issues dealing with the resolution today, what we're asking for is that the National Academy of Science do a third-party independent study on the social economic issues that are would come about because of a project such as the Pebble Mine and its potential size that everybody's been talking about. And there's a lot of debate out there about whether the state of Alaska has the ability to permit and manage a mine this size. And I'm not here today to talk about whether the state of Alaska has that ability or not. I don't know. I do know that the departments from the state of Alaska probably have the capability. And I'm not debating today about the environmental issues or whether they have the right permit process in place. My concern, and the concern that that's been expressed by the people, is the social economic issues that are out there. And when you look at a project of this size, which there are several, I don't know what you call them, maps or pictures that are hand-drawn pictures that are floating around that show the size of this potential deposit compared to other deposits that are currently being mined in the state of Alaska. Red Dog, Fort Knox, Kennington Mine in southeast here. And the pictures that I've seen are just a small, though all of those put together are just a small comparison to what the potential size of this deposit at Pebble are. The impacts that could take place in small communities, such as Iliamna, New Halen, Port Allsworth, Pedro Bay, Kakanak, Yigiagik, of a major production, major infrastructure, so to speak, being put in. As you can see if you look close at this thing, there's only one rough road that's on that map. And that's from, you can see from Shelikov's side over to the Big X where the Pebble project would be. There's no road connecting that. Just the concept of building a road from Shelikov into that Pebble mine to get all the equipment in there and everything else that go with it. The number of jobs that it's going to take to build that, to build the infrastructure, to put the mine in, and all that stuff is going to have an impact on the area. This is basically virgin land that we're looking at developing a great major project in. The impacts that can come from that, and my concern, are the social side of it. And a lot of money coming into a very remote area with eight communities in the area, plus the downstream, could have a very big impact. People come into the mine looking for work. They don't have a job. What happens to them? People make a lot of money all of a sudden, and you start talking about the alcohol and the drugs and everything that flows with money, big money. Those are the concerns I have. So those are the kind of questions that I'd like to see a third party, the National Academy of Science, take on and answer for us, and or bring questions to us that we should be asking the industry, the mining industry, as they get ready to put this project together. The resolution is before you. I've had staff been working on answers to questions that you may have in reference to the resolution itself, and I know there's a number of different people who have indicated that they planned on testifying today as well. With that, I'll leave it for questions that you might have. I can bring staff forward if that's your preference.
Thank you, Representative Osterman. Questions, committee members? We do have in the audience Dr. Keith Criddle, who can help the committee better understand the National Research Council committee process. Apparently, Dr. Criddle was a previous member of the council and has some experience dealing on other issues that came before the council. We have online a number of folks who wish to testify. We also have online representatives from the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Environmental Conservation, and so not seeing any questions from committee members.
I prefer I could have staff come up and walk real quickly through the resolution itself to put it on the record if that's...
Why don't we do that? We did hear this in the waning days of last year's session. It was a fairly good overview of the bill, but maybe we can have your staff come forward, Representative Osterman.
I'd like to have Charisse R.C. come forward, please.
And have Charisse come forward, and we'll revisit the measure so it's everyone is a little more familiar with the bill.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Charisse R.C., and I'm staff to Representative Osterman. I'm very happy to hear today to speak to you about House Concurrent Resolution 15, which requests the Legislative Council to contract with the National Research Council of the National Academy of Sciences for an independent assessment of the environmental and socioeconomic consequences and impacts of large-scale mineral extraction in the Bristol Bay watershed. During my testimony today, I will explain the purpose of the resolution and provide a brief background on the history of the National Research Council. I would also like to know, as Representative Osterman indicated, that there are several people here present and also online to offer testimony today. HCR 15 requests that the Legislative Council contract with the National Academy of Sciences for an independent assessment of known and probable cumulative environmental and socioeconomic consequences of large-scale mineral extraction in the Bristol Bay watershed. The purpose of this study is to assess critical gaps in existing knowledge, and it would serve as a tool available to legislators, the administration, and the public. It would help provide information on potential risks and benefits associated with large-scale mineral development. Essentially, the study would assess the cumulative impacts with the Pebble prospect itself and examine potential future development of this nature in the area once infrastructure is in place. Based on the history and the reputation of the National Academies for providing advice with standards of a scientific and technical quality and independence, HCR 15, requests the Legislative Council to contract with the National Research Council to conduct this study. The National Research Council, or the NRC, is part of the National Academy of Sciences, and in 1863, President Lincoln signed a congressional charter authorizing a non-governmental institution to honor top scientists with membership and serve the nation whenever called upon. They serve as advisors to the nation on science, engineering, and medicine, and it is the only institution chartered by the U.S. Congress to do so. Specifically, the Academy of Science was created to investigate, examine, and experiment and report upon any subject of science or art, whenever called upon by any department of the government. The mission of the NRC is to improve government decision-making and public policy, increase public education and understanding, and promote the acquisition and dissemination of knowledge in matters involving science, engineering, technology, and health. Some important points about the National Academies are the following. It is a nonprofit and operates independently from the government. They do not provide services to for-profit entities, and the scientists appointed to the committees serve without pay. Since 1990, there have been nearly 20 different studies and reviews conducted in the state. These studies have ranged from studying the decline of the stellar sea lions in Alaskan waters, to assessing the research efforts of the Oil Spill Recovery Institute, to reviewing the research and restoration plan for the Arctic Yukon Kuskokwim salmon fishery. And as Representative Edgman had noted, that there is also someone in the audience, Professor Criddle, to speak on his experience with the National Academy. The costs for the studies have varied depending on the scope of the work. Recent projects have ranged from $600,000 to $1.6 million. Ultimately, the fiscal impact of this study will be up to the discretion of the Legislative Council and the National Academies, but currently the fiscal note attached to this resolution is $1 million. The main draw to working with the National Academy is their commitment to independent advice. The Legislative Council, as a sponsor, would have no control over the conduct of a study once the statement of task and the budget are finalized. Study committees gather information from many sources in public meetings, but they carry out their deliberations in private in order to avoid political special interest and sponsor influence. An added benefit to this study will be to provide the public with reassurance that the legislature and the state are seeking as much information as possible to a very complex and contentious issue. The NRC is no stranger to conducting studies on contentious issues, which is evident in their 140 years of extensive experience. With that, I would like to end my testimony. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today and welcome any questions from the committee.
Questions, committee members, for Representative Osterman's staff, Representative Munoz.
Thank you. In the absence of a permit and not knowing the specifics of the project, how do you direct the Science Foundation to focus in on a number or size of the proposed project?
Through the chair, Representative Munoz, thank you for the question. We already know a great deal about the project. We know the type of ore body, and we know the location. We roughly know the methods at which the minerals would be extracted and the infrastructure that is needed. These are not variables. It is important for this study to be done, and as Representative Osterman mentioned, that there's socioeconomic impacts that may not be covered by the environmental impact statement. So I think there are a lot of variables that are not known, but in terms of this study in particular, there are things that are known.
And before we go to Representative Millett, assuming there are no follow-up questions, Representative Munoz, it was interesting in the hearing that we had a couple weeks ago with this committee, as well as the committee from the other side, where we saw an illustration from one of the principals that we asked to come and come before the joint committees. An estimation of the scope of the Pebble Project vis-a-vis all the other major mines in Alaska. And the numbers that I recall is if you took all of the major mines in Alaska, the five or six of them, and you grouped them together, that the recoverable ore bodies was something in the neighborhood of about 600 million tons. But the potential of Pebble, not saying that the ultimate project is going to encompass the entire potential in terms of deposits that that the Pebble Partnership has brought forward, but the overall, the potential size of the Pebble Partnership, the project could be upwards of 10 billion tons of recoverable ore. So when we're talking about scope and size, obviously you're looking at a mine that's of magnitude many, many times over any large size mine in Alaska. Representative Millett?
Thank you. This is either for Sharice or Representative Osterman. So when you talk about the socioeconomic impacts, are you talking about both positive and negative socio impacts? And could you describe, maybe give us an example of each one, a positive impact and a negative impact that you anticipate the study would bring forth?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, to rephrase your question, the study would address both positive and negative, and you're asking for an example of both?
Yeah, the socioeconomic impact.
If it's okay, you know, I'm not able to answer that at this time, but I can get back to you on that.
Sure, that'd be great.
Representative Osterman?
Yeah, thank you. And I think I mentioned some of the issues that come with the gold town type mentality and what happens in large developments like this when you've got very small communities that are associated in the same area. Obviously the positive side is the jobs and the amount of money that would bring into Stabil for a stable region that is basically run off of summertime fishing. And so there's a positive side there. On the downside of that also could be the fact that so much money then creates a number of different problems. I grew up in Alaska. I saw the boon and the bust of the king crab industry in my community. Kodiak was at the time was a fairly small community, yet we ended up with the largest crab fishery in the world, and the amount of money that was flowing through there and the amount of drugs and the amount of alcohol and the social problems that were created, that there was no funding coming forward to address those issues because most of that profit was going out to crew members who were just getting on boats or on airplanes and leaving town with their profits. So I think there's a number of different give and takes on both sides of the issue.
Follow up?
Representative Millett?
So with that in mind, if your study comes back and it says that you know, the positive and negatives are balanced, and you know, looking back through history and knowing that we've done some things, especially with impact money, I mean, I think that that's a good solution when you talk about not having any money available for some of the situations. I don't know how much worse some of the villages in west and southwest Alaska could be in at this point without the jobs, but I would imagine that having an impact fund associated with the mine would take care of some of that issues. I think when we talk about socioeconomic impacts, Alaska was born on booms and busts. I mean, we've seen it in fishing, we've seen it in gold mining, we've seen it in oil and gas. I think we've learned a lot from it. So I don't think having a large-scale mine, I mean, we can debate whether we think it's healthy for the fish or not for the fish, but as far as communities go, I mean, Alaska, this is what we were built on. This is our fundamental foundation as a resource extraction state, is that we develop the resources, and when those resources get to a point where they either level off or as in gold up in, you know, where my family was from, Nome, I mean, it realigns and it readjusts, but not to have resource development go forward because of the boom and bust mentality. I think that, you know, shame on us for thinking that way, but I think that we've learned a lot from the past exploration and development of our resources that we can prepare for those scenarios that may come forward. And I worry that coming out with a socioeconomic, while not science, is more of an art, may scare future miners from coming to the state of Alaska and investing in, because every time we have a mine go forward, we're going to ask for a huge, expensive research, what it's going to do to impact the communities. I think we know what it's going to do to impact the communities based on past history. So I find that argument a little difficult to swallow, frankly, with all due respect.
Did you want to respond, Representative Osterman?
Yeah, thank you. I find it interesting that we're discussing whether the mine built or not built. based upon the discussion today, and I want to try to rephrase that, because I'm not asking you to make a determination about whether the mine gets built or not. I'm not asking you to make a determination about whether we should do mining in Alaska. I'm asking you to take a look at this area where there's 8 small communities that are going to be impacted in one form or another, whether it's good or bad, I don't know, by a large mine and large infrastructure that it's going to take to put that mine together. We can, at some point in time, when we get to that point where we have to make a determination whether the state of Alaska wants to see this mine move forward or not, we can have this argument about whether mining is good or mining is bad, or whether we should step in the way of mining or not step in the way of mining. Those kind of arguments in reference to the environmental and the permitting and all the rest of that stuff is going to be comparison to going down on the Kenai at the head of the Kenai River and say we're going to take out 15 miles of this mountain right here, and that's because there's so much gold and whatever there is in there. Those are the kind of conversations we'll have at some point in time. My concern is whether the people of that area are going to be impacted, and I'm thinking maybe negative. I don't know until the environmental or until the assessment is done. That's what I'm asking for. Just take a look at what the social economic impact could be with a mine this size in an area that is dealing with just small communities like that.
And Representative Millett, I think I would add to Representative Osterman's comments by saying that your point is certainly well taken about sort of inhibiting the investment climate in Alaska, if you will, given that we are a resource development state. But as I think many of us here in this room in Juneau and those online who participated in the hearing that we had a couple of weeks ago, we saw pretty clear that this is not just another sort of quote-unquote major mine in Alaska. This mine potentially has the ability to, we're talking exponentially dwarf the large-scale mines that exist in Alaska. And it's not just the size, it's where the mine is placed, right next to the great fishery, great sockeye fishery left in all of, North America, but certainly the world. So, the old adage, measure twice and cut once, to me, really applies in this instance. And I don't know if other major development projects statewide would really present such sensitive trade-off situations, if you will, where you have a non-renewable resource located next to a renewable resource, and both of them are world-class in value, and both are competing and using and vying for the, ultimately the same water in some instances. So there are some questions here that, in my mind, that we should ask. We should do it now. We shouldn't do it later. We should take the opportunity to get a third-party assessment. And with that little bit of editorializing, Representative Osterman, before we go to public testimony.
One comment. What we're anticipating out of a study on the social economic is not whether the National Academy of Science can tell us definitively what's going to happen out there, but they also can bring forward, which is part of what we would request, is a series of questions that we should be, as legislators, asking as we go through this process of what, and I don't even know what those questions are, and that's why I don't know what to ask the mining industry. I don't know what to ask DNR. I don't know what to ask the administration about how I protect the citizens of the state of Alaska that live in that area. So if we had this study by the National Academy of Science, at least we'll have the opportunity then to know what we should be looking for, know what kind of questions we should be asking. But if we don't have the study, I think we're going to be sitting there saying to ourselves, I guess it's a good mine, let's build it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Not seeing any additional questions for Representative Osterman and his staff. We do have representatives from DNR and DEC online. Mr. Fogles or Ms. Kent, did you want to comment at this time?
Mr. Chair, this is Ed Fogles, Director of the Office of Project Management and Permitting within the Department of Natural Resources, and I have no comments at this time. Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, this is Lynn Kent, Director for the Division of Water at Department of Environmental Conservation, and I don't have any comments either right now. Thank you.
With that, let's go into public testimony, and let's start with Lorene Anilin with the Illiamina Natives Limited. Are you online, Lorene?
Do you hear me?
Yes, we do, loud and clear. Can you put yourself on the record, please, and state any affiliation that you might have?
My name is Lorene Anilin. I represent Illiamina Natives Limited, and I'm the president of the corporation. Wanted to comment on HCR 15 and the resolution that's being presented today. To me, it's premature, and it's concerning Pebble. And I feel that nothing has been put forth about development of Pebble or any... environmental impacts at this duplicate of the federal and state permitting structure. And we have a process that's already in place with under EIS through NEPA, and I think it's very stringent, and I feel that the impact of the fisheries in our lake area, we're not even considered part of the CDQ, yet we're considered as a major spawning grounds of Illiamina Lake, and I feel that since this is being presented today, it's more of a layer or any of economic development in our region. I feel it would be premature to add something else for any economic development within Illiamina Lake.
Are there any questions for Ms. Anilin from committee members? Not seeing any. Thank you, Lorene, for your testimony. Next, let me also ask, is there anyone else in Illiamina who wishes to testify this afternoon? Not hearing any. We will go to Dillingham, Robin Samuelson.
Yes, good afternoon, Representative Edwin. You hear me?
Yes, loud and clear, Robin. If you could put yourself on the record, please.
Well, thank you, and thank the committee for allowing the testimony on HCR number 15. My name is Robin Samuelson for the record. I represent the Bristol Bay Economic Development Corporation as the CEO president. BBDC supports HCR 15. We feel that that because of the magnitude of this mine, where it's going, the social environmental effects are going to be humongous. And I have personally worked with the National Academy of Sciences. They did a study on the CDQ program. I sat 9 years on the North Pacific Fishery Management Council and heard their testimony at the council, and I hold them in the highest esteem that nothing influences them people. They go in and do their work, and they come out with real good results in the studies that I've been associated with. I want to thank Representative Osterman for sponsoring this legislation. I think that with the 40-cent price of salmon that we had 4 or 5 years ago, we had turmoil in this region. I'm born and raised in this region. I've never seen turmoil like that attack the region. And Representative Osterman said that if the mine is permitted, the social consequences to the region, subsistence, lifestyles, cultures, is going to be under attack. So I think that the money that the if the legislature does do it, it'll be money well spent for the residents of Bristol Bay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Samuelson. Any questions? Not seeing any. We will, and let me also, I guess, ask as well, is there anyone else in Dillingham who wishes to testify?
Not at this time.
Okay, so we will move next to Anchorage, I believe it is. Teal Smith, BBNC.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes, a little muffled, Teal. If you might get a little closer to the mic.
Looks like I might have to eat this mic here.
Oh, okay. That's well enough. If you could put yourself on the record, please, and give us your testimony.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Teal Smith. I'm speaking today on behalf of Bristol Bay Native Corporation. I am a shareholder and BBNC's land and resource manager. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of HCR 15. This resolution allows for the independent assessment of large-scale mining in Bristol Bay. BBNC believes that the proposed study is a prudent and necessary investment in the state of Alaska's natural resources. Making funds available for a study of this nature will make more information available on the environmental and socioeconomic impacts of large-scale mining projects like Pebble Mine project currently being explored. BBNC's support of this review is based on the fact that the size and location of the proposed Pebble Mine are such that the mine could easily have adverse and unquantifiable impacts on the rich salmon and other resources of the region. These resources are fundamental to the more than 8,600 shareholders whose interests BBNC represents and to BBNC itself. Many of the questions that could be answered by an independent study will help formulate informed opinions for residents of the Bristol Bay, citizens of Alaska, and lawmakers as the permitting process for the mine begins. It is important to note that BBNC does not oppose responsible resource development, as it can present a viable opportunity for BBNC shareholders and the people of Alaska. But it must be done in locations and in ways that do not threaten area resources and economics. A third-party review of the impacts of large-scale mining in Bristol Bay will ensure that the state is well-positioned going into the Pebble permitting process to meet its obligations to protect Alaska and all its people from imprudent development. I appreciate, Mr. Chairman and committee members, the opportunity to speak on behalf of Bristol Bay Native Corporation today.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Not seeing any questions. Next, we'll go to Scott Thorson.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Scott Thorson. I'm here today just representing myself. I think that this particular study is something that's really not necessary. I don't believe that the expense is necessary. There are significant permitting steps that the mine would have to go through if a project actually ever gets going. And it's just, at the very least, it's very premature to spend this kind of money on this kind of a study. Thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Any questions for Mr. Thorson? Not seeing any. Dr. Caroline Woody.
Hello. Hello, Chairman and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak. I've come today, I'm representing myself, however, the Environmental Concerns Committee for the Western Division of the American Fisheries Society will be meeting to further support my statement. We just didn't have enough time to get everyone together for a conference call. You all did receive a resolution from the Western Division of the American Fisheries Society, which was passed unanimously in Albuquerque, New Mexico last year at the annual meeting. And in the resolution, it recommended a formal independent scientific review and survey of potential environmental and socioeconomic consequences of large-scale mineral extraction in the Bristol Bay watershed. The American Fisheries Society became aware of this particular project, and because of the size, the scale, the mine type, the fact that it's very large, it's also a copper and porphyry deposit, which has potential for impacts to water quality and the fact that it is a copper mine and that small increases in copper above natural baseline levels and that naturally occurring can harm salmon and also the zooplankton that they depend on as they rear and also other aspects of the food chain. It's very important that very careful studies be conducted in a thoroughly rigorous and scientific manner, and that information be available to the public and also to policy and decision makers relative to the assessing the potential impacts of this project. Because this potential project is so contentious, and because there is a stake in it by many different parties, an independent expert review can help augment the work that would have to be done by our state to assess the potential impacts of this project and can only help to make our review and assessment better. I think it's an important step to take, and I support this review and this particular resolution.
Thank you, Ms. Woody. Any questions for Ms. Woody? Not seeing any. Is there anyone else at the Anchorage side who wishes to testify on HCR 15? Not hearing any. Rick Helford? Rick, are you online?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Representative Edgman, for the opportunity to testify. And I enjoyed hearing the comments before. I would just like to add that, you know, over the years, the legislature has spent tremendous amounts of money studying major issues, and I think generally it's been very, very beneficial. I think the BP-ARCO merger would have gone very differently if the legislature hadn't spent the money and gotten involved. But it's not a very big issue to spend $1 million as a first step to the information chain, and advocates and opponents have consistently agreed that science is going to prove that either this mine is possible or it's going to prove this mine isn't possible. So getting the information certainly is very, very valuable to all of us. You know, it seems that one of the core questions is can we have both? Because as you have stated, this is an issue between billion-dollar interests on both sides. And the real question is, can you have the Bristol Bay fishery and can you have a mine of this size, scope, type, and in this location? And the National Academy is the kind of an entity that can go back and give you the questions you need to know the answers to before you decide that. I mean, does history or science or experience say that you can have both on a long-term basis? If it does, then you should go forward with that in mind. But if it doesn't, you should know that, and you should know the information. So I very much support your efforts to get the National Academy of Science involved. I think there's one small technical thing that you probably need to update in the resolution, and that's in the fifth resolve. That dealt with the size of the deposit before the recent February 10th update from the Pebble Partnership, which put the total mineable reserves up to 10.8 billion tons, which made it three times larger than the largest mine in North America. And I think you could change your resolve to whatever the numbers and come out in either the same terminology or just in terms of tonnage. But I would suggest you do that in the resolution. But with that, I commend you for taking it up. By the way, I'm speaking for myself, although I work with TU and RRC and with NUNUMTA, but I'm speaking just for myself, not for them particularly.
Rick, thanks for your testimony. For the recording clerk, can you identify those two acronyms?
Say again?
TU.
Trout Unlimited, Renewable Resources Coalition, and NUNUMTA Okutski.
Okay, and she's spelling NUNUMTA Luxtai as we speak, I can tell. Any questions for Mr. Helford? Not seeing any. Thank you for your testimony, Rick. We do have Dan Strickland. Are you online, Dan?
Yes, I'm here.
Can you put yourself on the record, please, and give us your testimony?
Yes, this is Dan Strickland for the record, and I'm speaking for the Alaska Marine Conservation Council, and which is known as AMCC. And we would strongly support an independent review of the potential consequences of large-scale mining in the Bristol Bay region. This review is essential in providing decision-makers and the public sound scientific information regarding the potential impacts of mining of pebble and the surrounding deposits. Bristol Bay salmon is one of the most ecologically and economically important renewable resources in our state. The salmon provide thousands of jobs and last year generated $129 million in ex-vessel value, according to ADFMG. Their salmon are the economic engine of Southwest Alaska and provide invaluable source of subsistence food, and they lie at the core of the indigenous cultures of the region. So any proposed mining that could impact this resource must be rigorously and thoroughly examined by an independent study. The citizens of Alaska, especially those that live in the region, deserve to know that they and the state have the best possible information on hand as plans for mining in the region progress. Bristol Bay is truly one of the crown jewels of our state, and we must ensure proper stewardship of its world-class fisheries resources and the many communities and fishermen that depend on their continued health. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Strickland. Not seeing any questions from committee members. We will next go to the Homer, I believe it is LIO site, Roberta Highland.
Yes, thank you. And I want to thank Representative Osterman and Edgemond for proposing this, sponsoring this. And I'm the president of the Kachemak Bay Conservation Society, and we strongly and emphatically support HCR 15 for its far-reaching foresight for a truly responsible mining decision regarding the proposed largest open-pit mine in North America. Quoting Governor Sean Parnell, we're never going to allow a mine that trades the future of one resource for another. And I think that says it well. So we really support HCR 15, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Roberta. I'm not seeing any questions. Do we have anyone else on the Homer LAO site who wishes to testify today?
Yes, we do.
Can you have them come forward, please?
Go ahead. Okay, your name.
Yes. Hi, my name is Elise Wolf, and I'm on the board of directors for the Kachemak Bay Conservation Society. And I would like to speak to, I have a couple of, one question, which is, I have heard that there is a permit in place or in the application process for 3.3 billion cubic yards of waste. I'm not sure if that's accurate or not, and if it is, then we have a concern that the estimated 10 billion cubic yards of, or metric tons, excuse me, 10 metric tons of ore that Northern Dynasty is currently promoting as the amount to be recovered from the area, that 3.3 billion cubic yards of waste doesn't realistically cover that amount of a material to be recovered, profitable material to be covered. So there's a question as to how much waste this mine would actually produce. One estimate that's floating around right now is 13 billion cubic yards. And there is a map that's being circulated by Sky Truth that has us very concerned, that shows the size of Anchorage with the waste mine material superimposed over Anchorage. It would take up over half of the city. So this kind of stuff really concerns us, and this is the kind of thing that we're thinking may not come down the line until one permit after another is applied and gotten. And so I think such a study is prudent in the event or in the purpose of trying to come up with total cumulative expectations of impact prior to going forward. Two questions that I have that KBCS has is Lake Iliamna ever going to be used as a disposal site for the waste? And if they are, is this going to be something they originally apply for? So those are my initial comments. Now I'd like to make a couple of comments about the three different impacts that this particular proposal addresses: economic, sociological, and cultural, and environmental. The comment by Representative Millett has me particularly concerned. I lived through the pipeline development, and my family suffered the sociological impacts of the pipeline because I have a brother who died of a drug overdose during the height of the pipeline. So underestimating the sociological costs of such a development is really not what we want to do on a personal level or on a cultural and sociological level. The economic impacts of the pipeline, for example, were felt all throughout the state in not very good ways in a lot of the different communities. In fact, we lost a lot of Alaskans during the pipeline. Now, of course, this mine doesn't compare to the pipeline, but this is a huge operation, and it does place at risk one of our most important sustainable industries, which is fish. And the comment that we are a resource development state, I can only hope that the people that make that statement or characterization of Alaska are including fish and tourists, because right now those two economic industries offer the most jobs for Alaskans. We do have a lot of people from Texas and Oklahoma still coming up here and taking our jobs, but for the state of Alaska, resource development state, I would agree with that if you include fish and tourists. And that's what this mine places at risk. To underestimate the cultural importance and the economic importance of salmon to the state of Alaska is to ignore 250 years of history, something that gold mining just cannot compete with. So if we lose these things, we are trading something we will never be able to get back. So those are the things that I'd like to say about this. And the environmental costs, of course, these are the things that you're supposedly, the state of Alaska is supposed to be looking into with the EIS and all of this. So anyway, I appreciate this proposal, and I'm really pleased that it's on the table and that you guys are hearing it, and the Fisheries Committee is looking at this seriously, and I truly support this HDR 15, and I hope it goes forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Will. Not seeing any questions. Is there anyone else at the Homer site this afternoon?
No, there isn't. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Millett.
Thank you. Just for the record, I just want folks to understand that I fished in Bristol Bay for 20 years, and I'm also Alaska native, so I'm very, very aware of the impacts that it's had on, boom and bust have had on the economy, so I just want to put that on the record.
Thank you, Representative Millett. Lisa Reimer, are you online, Lisa?
That's okay.
Oh. I'm sorry, before we go to Ms. Reimer, Representative Munoz.
I just wanted to point out in the last comments, part of the reason that this is concerning in some ways is that there's so much uncertainty about what's being studied. And just talking about the tailings issue, the figure of $3.3 billion was mentioned, and then $13 billion, and whether or not Iliamna Lake was going to be used. So, I mean, those are all variables that are quite distinct. So, gosh, it would be great if we had more specificity in conducting a study. But comment. Thank you.
Representative Munoz, we could call the bill sponsor back up here at any time. So if you wanted to address that specifically to Representative Osterman, we can address your question at this time, or if you wanted to wait and do it later. We do have somebody in the audience who has specific experience with the National Research Council. We can do it later. So I guess we'll just hold off for now. Lisa Reimer, are you still on?
Yes, I am.
Good afternoon. Can you put yourself on the record,
yes,
please?
Good afternoon. My name is Lisa Reimer, and I grew up in Iliamna, Alaska. And I think this resolution, it's too premature. Pebble has not even submitted a preliminary mine plan yet. And I'm worried about the duplicate of this with the state and federal permitting structure. This is a duplicate. What kind of precedent would this be set by this resolution? How would it impact other projects in the state of Alaska? It's just so much uncertainty with it. We're the ones that are Native corporations out there. We're the ones that get impacted by all these resolutions and these laws that try to get passed through the legislature to stop Pebble. But we're the ones that have to live there and figure out how to help our economy there. So with these regulations and these things that are out there, we're not sure how it could impact us later on. We just think it's just being rushed through, and we're not sure why it's being rushed at the last minute. There should be more education out in the region about this, because we're the ones that are going to be impacted. So that's what I have to say. Totally against it.
Any questions for Ms. Reimers? Not seeing any. Thank you for your testimony, Lisa. Next, we will go to, and I'm assuming you're an off-net site, so I had asked earlier if there's anyone else out in Iliamna who wished to testify. So next, we will go to Sean Docterman in Kodiak.
Yeah, good afternoon, Chairman Edgman, Special Fish Committee members. For the record, I'm Sean Docterman, a lifelong fisherman. I presently own and operate a vessel in Bristol Bay, and I've been a longtime participant. I'm speaking on my own behalf today. I'm in support of HCR 15 for a number of reasons. Number one, it's hard to see that you could have a renewable resource such as Bristol Bay that's been around for 100 years keeping the region productive and money coming in. And then you look at a 1% tax on a mine that stands the chance to pollute this renewable resource. And so we're looking at that, and I know we want to get to actually the National Research Council and National Academy of Sciences assessment for environmental and socioeconomic consequences. And one stands on top of the other, because if you take the environmental impact and you don't know actually what's going to happen, or and then you have a problem with discharge in that region, and you stand to lose the fishery, then you have a huge socioeconomic impact. I mean, you've got $132 million pumped in from Pebble, but they are a proponent of the mine. And the DNR, after mixing zones was changed by a former commissioner of Fish and Game that did the colloidal study and was a mining consultant, leads me to believe that we might have a problem with the permitting process. So instead of taking the word of a mining company and their studies, we need to have an independent study, and from somebody that we all trust, and I think we would trust a research council that everybody in the United States looks up to. So I don't want to take much up more of your time up, but I've been in a mine 1.5 kilometers in the ground in France, and the first thing you see is water being pumped out. Well, number one, where is Pebble going to put all that water? And number two, where are they going to get water to go through the ore with? So, you know, that's a big question that should be asked here. So thank you much for your time, and thank you.
Questions for Mr. Docterman? Not seeing any. Also at the Kodiak site, we have Alexis Kwachka.
Yeah, hi, Representative Edgemon and committee members. My name is Alexis Kwachka, and I'll be speaking for myself today. I'm a commercial fisherman, both here in Kodiak and in Bristol Bay. I'm in support of HCR 15. I'd like to point out, in 500 years, we haven't gotten it right yet. Industrialization and fish don't mix. Atlantic salmon are all but gone. Pacific salmon in the Northwest and California runs are well below the historic levels and fading fast. I think a third-party review is in order. I don't think we can put enough science in front of this project, and I encourage you to move this forward. We need to have way too much information. Maybe we're going to need a fourth review on this thing before we permit it. We're out of salmon. Bristol Bay is a great run, something we should all be proud of. and I urge you to move forward with HCR 15. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Kwatchka. Any questions here at the table? Not seeing any. Is there anyone else at the Kodiak site this afternoon?
No, there isn't.
Thank you. Is there anyone else online who wishes to testify on HCR 15? Not hearing any. Is there anyone here in the room in Juneau who wishes to testify on HCR 15? Not seeing any. Oh, we do have a hand raised back there. Would you please come forward, please? Yes, grab a seat there if you would, and identify yourself and anyone who or what your representation might be.
Thank you. My name is Tatiana Ascook. I grew up in New Haven. And I just wanted to say that I'm in support of HCR 15. I can see it as a tool for not only the legislators, but for the locals or the other people involved or interested to make the best educated decision about the studies. Through the third party review analysis on the current data available to the public, is brought to everybody, and the important thing about this is that it would be brought to the public and we would be able to make a decision about it. One thing that I can see as a benefit to myself as a person who's really involved and interested in this subject is that it will help me to analyze the situation right now and also through the permitting process of the Pebble Mine. So I can see it as a benefit to be able to bring questions through that maybe a social scientist or an environmental scientist would have, where I don't have the information right now to be able to criticize or to question the permitting process. So I think it would be really helpful for locals or anybody who's interested to be able to bring that data together and just have some good questions to ask. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tatiana. Are there any questions at the committee table? Not seeing any. We might need to get the spelling of your last name for the recording clerk, if we could get that at some point here. Anyone else here in Juneau wishing to testify? Not seeing anybody come forward or raise their hands. We'll close public testimony. We do have, as mentioned earlier, Dr. Criddle, who has a personal experience with the National Research Council. Mr. Criddle, if we could get you to come up at the table for a moment. We've got a couple of questions that have arisen here in the last few minutes. Maybe ask you to put yourself on the record, and really appreciate you availing yourself today.
Well, thank you, Mr. Edgeman, members of the committee. My name is Keith Criddle. I'm the Ted Stevens Professor of Marine Policy with the University of Alaska Fairbanks School of Fisheries and Ocean Science here in Juneau. I'm also currently the interim director of the Fisheries Division for the University of Alaska Fairbanks. I'm an 18-year member of the Science and Statistical Committee of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council, and I'm in my second three-year term as a member of the Ocean Studies Board of the National Research Council. And so I was approached this morning to be make myself available to be able to answer some questions about the study process with the Ocean Studies Board, how the National Research Council structures committees, how that process operates. And in that, I can speak both as a member of the Ocean Studies Board and as an individual who has served on five study committees, chairing one.
Representative Book.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for coming forward, and appreciate your taking the time and trouble. One of the formats that you're going to be undertaking here is called a statement of task. I was wondering if you could outline that for us and then give us an idea of the protocol for what that is exactly.
Okay, well, the statement of task is really the critical piece for defining how an academy study is going to take place. You think of it as the terms of reference. You're laying out what questions will be addressed. The development of that statement of task involves some give and take. So it's something where you would put forward what it is that you'd like to see considered. The academy would then take a look at that and provide you with feedback about whether the questions that you're asking are ones that can be addressed, whether the questions that are being asked are science questions that are appropriate for the Academy to address, and also to enter into discussion with you about the time frame that would need to go into the study and the type of expertise that would need to be sought as members of a study committee.
Follow up, Representative Book?
Yes, from my...
Did you finish, Dr. Riddle?
I was just going to add, I took a glance at the resolution on this, and under the section, be it resolved, that looks like a nice starting point for a statement of task. That would be sort of the general purpose statement of it, and then it would be followed by a series of more specific bulleted items that would identify specifically what would be undertaken on that. So that looks like sort of the beginning part of a statement of task.
Representative Book.
Right. So if I may be so bold as to guess, so this would be done in conjunction with the legislature where they would be working with you to apply our questions and your expertise to come up with some boundaries for this statement of task. Is that a correct assumption?
Yeah, that's the way that I've seen the process operate, that we have study sponsors and the staff of the board to which this would go would interact together. Once there's a draft statement of task, that would go out to the members of the board for comment and feedback, and that again would be brought back to the study sponsor to get to something that was doable and mutually agreeable.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Vice Chair Killer? No questions. Representative Kawasaki?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Dr. Criddle. In the sponsor statement from the representative, it mentions that there's about $132 million spent thus far in some of the environmental studies going on for Pebble. You know, I guess the fiscal note to this is about $1 million, and I'm just kind of curious what kind of a end product would we get for $1 million?
Well, the Academy studies produce reports. The scope of the report really depends on the statement of task and the resources that are made available for it and the time frame for analysis. If I might give an example, we have recently overseen completion of the first half of a two-part study. The study was to take a look at the impacts of oyster mariculture in Drake's Estero. That's a national seashore. That question was in part taking a look specifically at that, but we also paired that with an analysis of best mariculture practices. And so we had a very short turnaround study that was desired by Senator Feinstein to take a look at that specific issue of Drake's Estero and the science behind decisions related to permitting of an oyster mariculture operation within that estero, but then a continued study so that first study was about a 6 to 8 month study, and then the follow-on study that was taking a look at best mariculture practices, it was more a typical sort of Academy study that was on the order of an 18-month project. The short study produced a very fine, a short, concise report addressing the specific issues of that estero, and then the best practices report will produce a volume, probably a 300-page sort of thing.
And just
follow up, President Kawasaki,
by way of how much did one of those things cost?
I'm not involved in the financing on it, but I think that you're in that ballpark, what you're talking about. So I would guess that $1 million is in that kind of range that of a typical Academy study that's in an 18-month range. So an 18-month project has about a 12-month study period. So there's time leading up to it that is forming the general statement of the task. Then you've got about a 3-month period of sort of nailing it down between the Academy and the sponsor and soliciting members to serve on the committee. So forming the committee is kind of that first 3 months. Then you typically have about a 12-month study period where the committee participates in public hearings, gathers science information, prepares the backbone of a report, and then meets together to settle a final determination of a report and the specific language of that report. And then it takes about 3 months to get through the publication process and the release of that report to the sponsor and to the public.
Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Criddle. One of the statements in here or requests is that you investigate some of the socioeconomic impacts to the area, and I'm just kind of curious. I know there's a lot of concern over what that, what happens. Obviously, something changes if a mine were to go through, but I'm just kind of curious how you would quantify that sort of data.
Well, there are a number of different boards within the Academy, ones that deal with economic issues and social science issues, as well as those that deal with issues such as water quality and fisheries. So the expertise can be drawn together to take a look at the science of these types of impacts. That would be an example of a term that would need to be fleshed out when we ask about socioeconomic impacts or sociocultural impacts. I think there would be a desire from the Academy to have a bit more specificity of what types of impacts are we interested in and concerned about here. Are we focused on employment issues? Or are we focused on economic effects, regional expenditure patterns? Are we concerned about aspects of impacts to local societies and cultural effects? Those are the types of things that we'd want to see spelled out a lot more in a lot more detail within the statement of task, because that would go a long ways towards helping to identify the type of expertise that would be sought for a committee. So with the committee selection process, there is an open call for nominations to the committee. Nominees to the committee are matched against a list of expertise that is required in order to conduct the analysis. The committee members are considered for possibilities of bias, so that we can make sure that the committee is not going to generate a biased report. And the committee is looked at to be drawn from a broad range in the Academy, not just so you don't have everybody from one institution and one region of the country that's involved in the analysis on that. Once the committee has been formed, the first task the committee is asked to go through for itself is to ask, do we as a committee have the expertise to accomplish the statement of task? And at that point, if there are gaps in the expertise, those gaps are often addressed by adding to the committee, again, through a nomination and selection process.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Millett.
Thank you. Dr. Kittle, it's nice to see you here. I also have some questions about the socioeconomic impacts and how you would deduct, data from that, socioeconomics sometimes, and cultural economics for that matter, are more based on an art rather than a concrete science. So an impact to a community, a social impact or a cultural impact, how do you go about categorizing that? Or how do you make that judgment? What's the criteria that you would base that upon, and who would have the expertise in doing that?
Well, Chairman Edgman, Representative Millett, this is not my area of expertise. My background and training is in resource economics and fisheries management, but I have had an opportunity in my capacity as a member of the Science and Statistical Committee with the North Pacific Council and on these NRC panels to work with people who have backgrounds in human dimensions in anthropology, in sociology, in rural studies. And these individuals have very well-developed scientific methods for addressing questions that are of interest to their disciplines. So I'm confident that there is expertise, that there are quantifiable and discrete methods for measuring different types of social and cultural impacts. They are not ones that I have any expertise in.
Follow up,
Representative Millett.
And have you ever done those types of studies before? Have you gone and had the scope of work, and can you show us some comparisons of other cultural and socioeconomic studies that you've done that you could point to that I could look for confidence in that art form?
Well, the first National Research Council committee that I served on was one that took a look at the implementation of individual fishing quotas. And in that committee, we had, in addition to fisheries biologists, people with background in fisheries management, we had a couple of economists besides myself. We had a couple of anthropologists. We had some law specialists. And that report, titled Sharing the Fish, came out in 1999, would be a good example of a study that includes elements of very specific resource management science issues and a very thorough discussion of cultural effects of individual fishing quotas and alternative management systems that could go into place. That project had a sister study that was underway at the same time on the community development quotas, and I believe Robin Samuelson mentioned that earlier in his public testimony. That one had a much larger component of social scientists engaged in it. And so that would be a real good place to take a look at the type of work that was done, the kinds of questions that they were able to explore.
Thank you, Representative Millett. I'd like the record also to reflect that Representative Johnson joined us several minutes ago.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome, Greg.
Thank you. I apologize for my tardiness. I'd overbooked Monday, not being in sync with the change of schedule, Mr. Chairman. I apologize.
Manic Monday.
Is it Monday? It is
Monday.
No, you don't
want to be seen. Additional questions for Dr. Criddle while we have him here at the table? Representative Kawasaki.
Thank you. Just briefly, obviously, I mean, you've sort of followed this whole Pebble controversy. It's, you know, we've got a letter from the Miners Association that says, kill this resolution. There's folks on the other side that said they definitely need this. Why do you think that, you know, this is sort of, as far as I know, an independent organization to try and vet information and come up with some non-biased information? Why do you think that you're getting attacked, or why do you think this organization is getting attacked? Why do you think this resolution is getting attacked?
I'm afraid that's sort of outside of my expertise. As a citizen, I've paid attention to the newspapers. I've read the articles. I've been interested in the issues. I've had research projects that have focused on salmon out of Bristol Bay, projects that have dealt with subsistence fisheries, commercial fisheries, sport fisheries. So I'm very interested in the issues, but I have no direct expertise on that. As a member of the academy, of the university system, academia, if anything, I have a bias that says studies are great. I get involved in them. I think they're neat. As a taxpayer, I also recognize that there is an obligation for fiscal responsibility. The funds that government administers on behalf of the citizens are precious to the citizens, and it's appropriate and important for citizens to be able to take a look at how it is that those funds are expected to be spent and to voice opinion on that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I have just a couple
Representative Munoz.
Thank you. Could you tell me how long this study might last and whether or not you would utilize Alaskan scientists, or would you also bring in scientists from outside?
Okay, again, it wouldn't be me. One of the first things that would have to happen with this would be determining what board would take on this project. So the National Research Council is organized into a series of divisions. I expect that this would fall under the Division of Earth and Life Sciences. Within the Division of Earth and Life Sciences, there are a number of boards. My experience is with the Ocean Studies Board. I've had a little bit of experience with the Polar Research Board. The Ocean Studies Board deals with fisheries issues more than other boards generally do. But there is a board on water science and technology that might be a very likely home for this project. There's a board on earth sciences and resources that's also a likely home. We often have studies that are jointly administered by boards. So if you've got a study that sort of has overlapping issues, it could quite likely be administered by a combination of boards. Typical, and the length of the study depends on what the questions are. Very narrow, specific questions can be handled in a fairly short study at a fairly short, fairly cheap price. More involved questions that require some research and complicated issues are going to take longer. In my experience in the studies that I've participated in, the studies that I've seen go through, 18 months is a pretty typical time frame, with about 12 months of that being focused on the study itself. I would anticipate that as the Academy structure the committee, that certainly they would welcome nominations of scientists from Alaska to serve on that committee, and I would anticipate that not only would they welcome those, but they would look for at least some local representation. It helps to have people that have some direct familiarity with what the issues are and what the setting is to engage in that study. So with the individual fishing quota study as an example, I was here in Alaska. It dealt with the halibut fishery and sablefish fishery as one of the earliest fisheries to go into an individual fishing quota setup. I was young in my career, and so it was a little unusual for me to be involved in a panel at such a young stage in my career. But I hadn't had any political statements or involvement in the issue. I had a research expertise in it, and I had some local knowledge, and so I think that that was part of what invited me to serve on that. By contrast, I was also a member of a committee taking a look at the science questions involved in the introduction of a non-native oyster to Chesapeake Bay. Having no expertise in oysters, no expertise in Chesapeake Bay, but having a background and understanding in the economics and management of fisheries, and they wanted to have somebody that didn't have a dog in the fight that could come in and participate in that study. And so I would expect that you would see something very similar in the construction of a committee that would take on this project.
Follow-up, President Munoz.
Once you had your questions, would you then anticipate having to structure various proposals, various responses for various sizes of a project, since we don't have a specific project plan?
If there's not a specific size involved, I think that those would be important issues that the committee would want to look at. And you can take on those types of questions in a what-if framework. So you can look at what types of impacts might be important things at different scales of development of a project. The committee reports sometimes are a very good way of getting at answers to questions. Other times, they're very helpful ways of identifying the questions that ought to be asked. The most recent committee I served on was one that I chaired on the adequacy of domestic and international law for dealing with marine debris. Now, in that question, we were really asked to frame What were the current limitations with law and regulation that were preventing us from eliminating marine debris as an issue? And so in many ways, our report summarized the current state of knowledge and highlighted those areas that were policy issues that would need to be addressed by legislative bodies if they chose to do so, and by international bodies. And we've highlighted areas of what is unknown in terms of the cumulative quantities and impacts of marine debris.
Representative Johnson, do you have any questions for Dr. Criddle?
You know, actually I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you tell me how, just walk me, and maybe you covered this, and if you did, I apologize. Walk me through the process of how people are chosen to be on the board once we set a guideline. And I spoke with Elizabeth Eide, who is a senior program officer with the Boards of Science with the National Research Council. And she indicated that basically you send out, you have a group of scientists in all these fields, and you send out kind of a request, who would be interested in serving on this board. Is that kind of how it goes? And then you get the people in and they say, I'd be interested, I could do it, I have the time. Is that kind of how that works, or it's kind of a voluntary basis?
Yeah, very, very close to that. So the first thing is taking a look at the statement of task and trying to identify what expertise is going to be needed. And then the call for nominations goes out looking for that expertise. And so a study like this might say we're looking for individuals with backgrounds in hydrology and the geology, in mine development, in economics, in cultural aspects of development in rural regions. So there would be a call that would identify the types of expertise that are being looked for. Individuals can nominate themselves for that. They can be nominated by others. Nominees are asked to provide information about their expertise, documenting the qualifications that they would bring. And then the Academy takes a look at that and selects individuals from out of that slate of nominees for the study.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it, Mr. Chairman. And who makes, and so the Academy makes that selection?
Yeah.
Who is that exactly? When you say the Academy, is that also chosen by someone who says you've got the time to do it in this area and review the resumes, or is that chosen also by the same kind of process of going out and who's got the time, who's got the expertise in reviewing these?
Okay, so there are full-time employees of the National Academy of Science that hold administrative positions and science director type positions. There are also individuals who are elected to be members of the Academy. And those individuals serve on a voluntary basis and a non-compensated basis, much as board members of the individual committees and boards serve.
Representative Johnson.
They feed us well, but.
Right, and I understand that. And I've been through this, so I kind of know the answers, so I want to make sure to get them on the record. How do you verify that there are no conflicts?
On that, people are asked to go through a declaration process where they declare where they might have conflicts of interest or biases. Conflicts of interest are generally not going to be permitted. People with a clear conflict of interest are not going to be permitted to serve on a committee unless it's the only way of bringing the expertise in. And an example of that would be on this marine debris committee that we recently completed. We needed to have some expertise coming out of industry. We really needed some of the expertise of people who were harbor masters and managers, of people who represented shipping associations. They had a conflict of interest, but it was a stated conflict. They were able to assert to us that they would be able to form judgments independent of the organization that they served with. And so that was one of the places where the Academy chose to walk the gray line and say, we need this expertise, the only way to have it. The people who have it are all going to have this conflict. And so we need to look for individuals that are well-respected, that have a strong background, but can still bring this expertise.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is this list of names available to the public?
Oh, yeah. So once the slate of committee members has been identified by the National Academy, that slate of committee members, or the slate of proposed committee members, I should say, is made public, and there is an opportunity for public comment on that slate of nominees. Based on that public comment and on committee discussions about any conflicts or potential conflicts of interest, then the Academy makes a final decision and appoints the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. May I?
Yeah, Representative Johnson.
Is the question ever asked of someone who's being selected? Have you ever been contacted by either side of this issue?
That's something that probably would come up as part of I'm not sure that being contacted by would represent something that would raise a flag, but holding a contract from one of the parties involved in it, or having issued public statements that were in support of or in opposition to the item that was being brought up for study, those would be viewed as conflicts of interest. But taking a telephone call or sitting down and talking with individuals from different sides probably would not rise to that level of being identified as a conflict of interest. I have, in the committee vetting process on committees I've served on, people have at times brought up those types of things and asked in this open committee meeting if this is something that people view as potentially creating conflict.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mitch. And the purpose of this is I have asked several people who've been involved, and I've been working on doing something like this for over 2 years, so it's not my first attempt at looking at an independent study. And there is the opportunity for conflicts. And if we go down this road, we want to make sure that there's not an opportunity for someone to in advance screen potential participants. I know that has happened in the past, and it's been very contentious when that did happen. And so what I want to do, and I want to go back to the question about pre-selection or is there a list? Can I go on the internet and find out who participates in the National Academy of Science Studies today?
Yes,
1,000 people or whoever they are.
Yep.
So I could narrow it down, and I could start making contacts and putting them on mailing lists and starting.
Well, you could identify who is currently serving on a committee. You could identify who has served on committees in the past. You could identify all of those individuals who are members of the Academy of Science. But then the committees are drawn from across the spectrum in the United States and outside. So committee members are typically from universities, most typically, but they can be from resource management agencies. They can be from stakeholder groups that have particular expertise, so they can be drawn from across the spectrum. So you wouldn't really be able to identify the slate of possible nominees. But once that nominee slate is out, again, that will be public, and it is viewable.
Representative Johnson, we do have one more bill that I, at very minimum, want to get the bill sponsor, who's been very patient with us. If we could, one more question. And
Mr. Chairman, is it your intention to try to move this today, or am I going to have another shot?
I think you're going to have another shot, Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Then I certainly don't want to keep someone. Are we talking about in this committee?
Yeah. What's that?
Just to clarify, are we talking about in this committee I'll have another shot?
Well, Representative Johnson, that's where the bill resides.
I understand that. I also see another referral on here.
When were you leaving? When were you leaving town, Representative Johnson?
I'm here for the duration. How many members are in the big pool? What are we talking about? 100,000, 10,000, 5,000, 3,000?
Oh, potential scientists that would serve on this. Mm-hmm. I think you could sum up the number of academics at universities, and you you know, be in the general ballpark, so you are certainly talking hundreds of thousands of potential people. And ones that likely have expertise to specifically address this question is going to be a much narrower set.
So, Mr. Chairman, my point is that if there are 50,000 potential out there, as much money as we're talking about at stake on both sides, I want to make sure that, we get a fair hearing, that all of a sudden the 50,000 potential members aren't all of a sudden deluged with mailings like I get on a fairly regular basis, or TV ads from both sides of this issue, right or wrong. And so I'm concerned that, we have a fair and balanced issue, and that if we do go down this road, that we can be confident at the end of the day that it will stand up under court challenge, as well as the red face test and the public scrutiny that we're going to have to face by going down this road. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate the need for expedience.
Well, the chair will allow one more question before we put this bill aside and move to House Bill 266. Vice Chair Keller.
Thank you. This is a partly just trying to grasp the group of people that are members of the Academy, the scientists. Would the in the EIS process, when we permit a mine, there'll be an environmental impact statement, and NEPA requires the environmental impact statement. And of course, part of that process, in fact, it's actually written by third-party scientists that are hired by the federal regulators. I would assume that it, we're talking the same pool of scientists that would write the, potentially the EIS and who would come up with a statement of task and fulfill it as a result of this bill.
I think it would be really unlikely that somebody who was directly involved in writing the EIS would be eligible to serve on the committee that would be an Academy committee report on this.
Follow-up, Vice Chair Keller.
Okay, I wasn't thinking specifically about the same person, but I was just really, the heart of my question is what can we expect from this process of a study that would be different than what we would get out of the environmental impact statement? It has public hearings, three of them at least, in the process, and I think that the experts in that process are the same as the experts, the same group, the same, you know, I think, I'm asking, that was the question, you know, as we would be drawing from here, just a different process, it'd be through the NRC and the Academy, right?
Again, that would depend a little bit on the specific questions. So an EIS might not have very much focus on the economic impacts and sociocultural impacts, and so you'd expect the committee would be broader in its set of interests, but you would expect that the committee would have people with similar expertise to those involved in the EIS when it came to aspects of water quality, aspects of mine technology. So I think that you'd see some of that same type of expertise brought in.
Thank you.
With that, Dr. Criddle, thank you for coming to the hearing today. And it's the chair's intent to set HCR 15 aside and next to direct the committee's attention to HB 266. With apologies to Representative Stoltz and the staff, they've been out there waiting patiently for, well, at least an hour or so, years. So sorry about that, Bill.
Mr. Chairman, would you entertain a motion?
Entertain a
Oh my gosh.
I've got friends in high places. Representative Stoltz, good afternoon.
Well, thank you, Chairman Edgman and all the members of the committee. This really has been years. I first introduced this several years ago, and you were the first Fisheries Committee chairman to bring this forward to have public debate on it, and that's a sincere thank you on that. It is an issue relevant to a large part of the state. Tens of thousands of users of personal use fisheries, an all Alaskan resident fisheries, I guess fisher it is. Mr. Chairman, it's pretty. Nothing is simple here, but it's. I tried to address my concerns about fisheries management in as simple as manner as I could, as in a time of. When there are shortages and management decisions had to be made, that the personal use fisheries that put wild Alaskan fish protein. I predominantly sockeye salmon on the dinner tables and the freezers of Alaskans. That resident-only fishery be ahead of commercial and sport fishing, both but behind subsistence. So it's that's really the crux of it. This is it's not as complex as that. It's really one of the policy issues that but there are a lot of players, people that are used to the way things have gone on forever, as regions of the state have evolved in population and different uses. It's put pressures on some areas of the state, particularly Cook Inlet. And this isn't, although personal use fisheries do occur in other areas, primarily it's Copper River and Cook Inlet on the Kenai Peninsula, and there's a smattering of other smaller personal use fisheries. I am carrying an issue that's important to the interior of Alaska. It's important to South Central Alaska. It's talking to people. It's not a slam dunk decision, even on the Kenai Peninsula. Many residents there who aren't engaged in the for-profit practice commercial fisheries are in favor of the personal use fisheries. And many more make a living on sport, but that's just an aside. There has been an evolution or change from people, I guess, in our fisheries, and I think this priority will reflect how we can affect a more positive management of our fisheries to recognize this Alaska resident-only fishery that puts wild Alaska protein that we promote is the best protein in the world. I sit on ASME, and I agree with that wholeheartedly. On Alaskans' dinner tables and that protein in Alaskan freezers, that's really, it's as simple as that. Although it's, I guess it'll be described as much more complex, but that's my notion of it.
Thank you, Representative Stoltz. For those online, and we have accumulated, I'm going to guess we've got about 20 people who have signed up to testify. And we've also got, representatives from the Department of Fish and Game Law, both here in person and online as well. We've got, unfortunately, about 15 minutes till the 5 o'clock floor session that's been scheduled earlier in the day. And so what I'd like to do, Representative Stoltz, is to have your staff at least walk us through the change of the bill itself. It's fairly straightforward, and the amendment is straightforward as well, and then have the department comment on the amendment. And then have the committee at least have the opportunity to maybe to offer any questions if there are any.
And Mr. Chairman, you mean the amendment made the change in the verbiage in the CS before us?
Yes, and we do have a CS for discussion purposes, Vice Chair Keller.
Yeah, I'd like to move to it's version S for the working document.
And I'll object for discussion purposes. Representative Stoltz.
I wish you luck in coaxing out any kind of official position from either of those departments that'll be here. But
I'm getting very practiced at it. I can say that much in other committees.
I know the governor's position is that when he was a legislator, he made me look pretty milquetoast. He was in favor of an allocation percentage, but I'm much more respectful of the board processes. That aside, can I? Depart at the committee after you get ready for something else.
Yes, thank you, Representative Stoltz. We can direct any questions to your staff, and appreciate your patience very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. For the record, my name is Ben Mulligan, staff to Representative Stoltz. In version S, let me preface this first. We've heard from the department before. They're not taking an official position, but I did ask for their assistance for the technical accuracy of the bill. So the definition which we changed, you'll notice on line 6, just it references, instead of escapement goal, it references management goal. And then we changed correspondingly from line 8 through 10, we changed the definition to management goal, because with a definition of escapement goal, it alluded to only fisheries that had runs. So we I asked the department for a definition of something that would be more inclusive, and management goal was the definition I was given to be more encompassing of all the personal use fisheries in the state. and that is the changes that were made from the version that you had at the last meeting and this draft that you see before you.
Questions for the bill sponsors, staff, on the changes to actually to the CS that's before the committee? Not seeing any. Ben, we'll next ask the department to come up here. And thanks also for your patience. Mr. Swanton and Ms. Juhas. Can you put yourself on the record? And we'd like to hear from you on the changes to the bill.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Charlie Swanton, and I am the Director of Sport Fish for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mr. Mulligan is correct in that we exchanged several emails with regards to the wording, and primarily the changes that were made were truly reflective of personal use fisheries around the state, not being germane specifically to salmon fisheries, which typically have references to escapement goals, and we have a variety of those, but more towards a broader base with regards to the personal use fisheries. And that's pretty much the extent of comments, Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Juhas, do you have any comments?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Jennifer Juhas. I'm the legislative liaison for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I have no further comments to my previous testimony.
Questions, committee members? Representative Millett, did I see your hand?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Book.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate you guys both being here, and I would like your comments on the title. There's a couple things in the title in and of itself where we have changes of practice, number one, regarding sustained yield, and the other one is whether or not there might be challenges constitutionally when you talk about residences. So could you address those two particulars in the title alone?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Book, with regards to the constitutional elements of this, I believe that we have Department of Law on the line.
Mr. Nelson, are you online?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I am.
If you heard the question properly, could you put yourself on the record and respond to it, please?
Certainly. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Lance Nelson. I'm a Senior Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law Civil Division, and I'm one of the attorneys who advises the Board of Fish and ADF&G and defends their actions. As to the question about the constitutionality of preferring residents, I don't think there's a serious issue there, because generally the courts have ruled that when fish are harvested and they're not intended for to enter into the stream of commerce, such as sport cod fish, recreational fishing, subsistence fish, and not going to be for sale, then most constitutional issues disappear in that regard. As long as it could be justified that the residents, there's a demand for resident harvest of fish, that that there's a legislative determination that that kind of preference is needed to meet that demand, then I think you're probably safe constitutionally.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, on that point.
Fook. Mr. Hilsing, are you online as well?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
John, my question is that when we're talking personal use fisheries across the state, we're talking about a great many fisheries outside of just the dip net fisheries. So the concern has been expressed to my office many times over by a great number of commercial fishermen, for example, has been the sort of unintended consequences of a statute change that House Bill 266 would propose. So I'd like to hear from you just, you know, what the impact might be to some of these fisheries that are on the sideline, if you will, to the dip net fisheries, and really would sort of get swept along with this change in Title 16 that's being proposed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, my name is John Hilsinger, Director of Commercial Fisheries. There are quite a variety of personal use fisheries in the state besides the dip net fisheries that we talked about in Cook Inlet. We also have some personal use salmon gillnet fisheries in Cook Inlet. There's also a variety of personal use fisheries that target hatchery stocks. For instance, the China Poot dip net fishery in Kachemak Bay, the Fish Creek dip net fishery up in Kinnick Arm that was originally designed to target surplus hatchery stocks. There's also some fisheries like that in Southeast Alaska where their personal use fisheries are set up specifically to harvest surplus hatchery fish. In addition to that, we've got personal use fisheries for shrimp, king crab, tanner crab, dungeness crab, scallops, clams, abalone, herring, bottom fish, halibut, and smelt around the state in almost every management area of the state. So there is a quite a difference. I envision that this bill would have to work through the Board of Fisheries adopting management plans or regulations that would lay out how the preference would be applied. You do have some situations where you might wonder how that would work. For example, in the sablefish fishery in Southeast Alaska, in the personal use fishery, there's no bag or possession limit. And we have a commercial fishery there that has been reduced in recent years. So I think the board would have to work through a management plan situation to determine how they would handle the situation where they decided that a reduction in the personal use harvest of sablefish was needed, and how they would balance then between the commercial fishery and the personal use fishery. I don't know if you have questions about specific fisheries, but that sort of gives you an idea of the range of fisheries and what some of the issues might be in trying to develop management plans to deal with them.
So John, is changing the term escapement goal to management goal, does that put more of the responsibility of implementing this bill in the hands of the Board of Fisheries? Is that what I'm hearing you saying?
Mr. Chairman, of course, Lance Nelson might have some thoughts about that, but the bill specifically refers to the Board of Fisheries putting regulations or putting restrictions on other fisheries. I think the change from escapement goal to management goal was a good one in that we primarily only have escapement goals in salmon fisheries, and as I noted, we have personal use fisheries for a whole variety of species. And some of those species are managed more on biomass thresholds or harvest rates or other kinds of management goals that are not really similar to an escapement goal that we would use in a salmon fishery. So I think that actually does provide a little bit broader latitude for the board within which to work.